Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. The mildest thing you can say about 9/11 is that the government was asleep at the switch, and the official report is a crock. Some so-called 9/11 revisionists say no, the government knew the attacks were coming, and, to serve its own purposes, let them happen. Some go even farther and say the government planned and executed the attacks, again, for its own purposes. Is this totally nuts, or do the revisionists have at least a very plausible story? It's hard to decide. The central question seems to be, to what murderous lengths will a modern government go to obtain some unworthy but profitable end? We'll begin by taking a wide look at some of the things our rulers have done since World War II. Then we'll focus in on one fascinating and amazingly little-known incident that happened 41 years ago. During the so-called Six-Day War of 1967, Israel tried very hard to sink an unarmed American Navy ship in international waters, and tried very hard to kill every sailor aboard. What the heck were the Israelis trying to do? Send a message to Saddam Hussein? And why did the U.S. government do everything it could to hush the incident up and stifle all criticism of Israel? We'll explore this fascinating story this week and next. It might change how you think about 9/11. It might make you want to dump the bosses off your back, as the song goes. One thing it won't do, it won't make you want to join the Navy and see the world. So stay tuned for Israel Attacks the U.S. or Day of Infamy, the sequel. On June 5th, 1967, the State of Israel surprised most of the world. Without warning, it launched a war against four neighboring states: Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. Yes, Iraq. Remember how one of Bush's many complaints about evil old Saddam Hussein was that Saddam considered Israel to be Iraq's enemy? I wonder if Saddam remembered something most Americans didn't remember, or never knew. For the record, Iraq never started a war against Israel. Why did Israel do all of the above? To be sure, Egypt's President Nasser had been doing a bit of saber-rattling, but I doubt anyone took that very seriously. In mine humble opinion, Israel's goal was the same goal it apparently is pursuing to this day: to expand its territory to, at least, all the land from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. You recall that the so-called West Bank extends to the Jordan River to the east, and the Gaza Strip borders the Mediterranean to the west. Indeed, in this brief 1967 war, known as the Six-Day War, Israel captured the regions known as Gaza and the West Bank, and the Golan Heights and other areas as well. Today, 41 years later, Israel still occupies these territories and, truth be told, seems to be in no great hurry to return them. The United States was officially neutral in the Six-Day War. Israel won the war handily. It's been reported that, in the war's first half hour, Israel destroyed the air forces of all four countries it was attacking. During this brief war, a handful of events occurred that triggered massive cover-ups by the governments involved. Here's one. A clearly marked U.S. Navy ship, minding its own business in international waters of the Mediterranean, off the coast of Egypt, was viciously attacked and very nearly sunk, and two-thirds of the crew killed or injured by the Air Force and Navy of Israel. Not Iraq, not Syria, Israel. As night follows day, the atrocity was followed by a government cover-up. Of course by Israel, amazingly also by the United States. This cover-up makes the 9/11 cover-up look like a model of transparency and good government by comparison. That's why the incident still matters. Let's step back and take a broader view. Here the atrocity was committed by America's closest buddy and news of it suppressed by the U.S. government. In the Gulf of Tonkin, quote, incident, unquote, which happened only shortly beforehand, the government invented an attack on a U.S. Navy ship that never happened, and used this as a pretext for steeply escalating our aggression in Vietnam, and used it as a pretext for giving President Lyndon B. Johnson the authority and power to conduct the war as he saw fit. Does this sound at all familiar? Does this remind you of anything that happened in, 2001, 2002, 2003? Incidentally, the name of the ship that was allegedly but not really attacked by the Vietnamese was widely publicized and is still well known, the USS Maddox. Later, there was the USS Pueblo incident. The Pueblo, a spy ship, entered North Korean waters and was captured. The captain and crew were briefly detained, treated well, and questioned politely, released, and were heading back home when the U.S. launched a bombing campaign at Korea, supposedly to rescue our supposedly imprisoned and brutally treated sailors. Not to forget the granddaddy of them all, the Lusitania, a British ship, supposedly an unarmed passenger liner, actually an armed vessel carrying munitions in support of combatants in what became World War I. When the ship quite reasonably was torpedoed by the German Navy, England used this so-called atrocity as an excuse for diving into the European war. Shall we go back to the battleship Maine, which somehow exploded in Havana Harbor? Probably from its own stores of damp gunpowder? We blame this on Spain, and used it as a pretext for liberating the Spanish colonies of Cuba and the Philippines. The moral of the story? Stay away from anything that floats, including ivory soap, and especially what Israel is now flooding the land and water of the Palestinian West Bank with, untreated human waste. We'll get to that story next week. But let's step back a bit. Phony naval incidents are handy to our rulers, as there are few witnesses and usually no reporters from Al Jazeera. But it doesn't have to be a ship. Consider the political assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Malcolm X. Each killing served the interests of some of our nation's rulers by removing a person they thought they could depend on, or at least disregard, but who later changed and became an obstacle, like Manuel Noriega of Panama and Saddam Hussein also, both CIA alumni. In many cases, a high-level investigation was held after the assassination, and a word-filled report was issued and promptly filed in the fiction section of bookstores and libraries coast to coast. Which brings us to the 9/11 cover-up commission. The Bush regime did everything it could to prevent an investigation, and then, when that failed, they did everything they could to ensure that the investigation and the official report would be not only implausible but near meaningless. In this they succeeded. I've never been a conspiracy buff, so-called, but if you just read the news for enough years, and your brain hasn't rotted away from watching TV, and worrying about who will be the next American Idol, and whether Brad will find true happiness with Angelina, and when poor Britney will be able to afford a pair of underpants, and, where was I? Oh, yes. If your brain hasn't rotted away from worrying about whether the $10 billion worth of free publicity from that sexy photo shoot will hurt Miley Cyrus's career, if your brain is still functioning and you live long enough, you begin to notice a pattern. A pattern of atrocities that benefit certain powerful people, hurt everybody else, and kill a certain number. Atrocities either perpetrated by the government or connived in by the government, or at least, as in the naval atrocity of 1967, condoned and covered up by the government. Hearings are then held that are obviously a sham. Obvious, that is, to anyone who troubles to look closely. A report is issued that is implausible on its face. The corporate media proclaim, "That should put to rest any lingering doubts." All blame is assigned to some low-life misfit, some working-class sad sack too poor to afford a good lawyer. Always a loner. Always a lone gunman. Always a lone gunman, a high school dropout from East Jesus, Tennessee, or West Podunk, Oklahoma. Or, recently, a famous Arab Muslim terrorist you never heard of before. Look at the list of lone gunmen. We don't have to go back to John Wilkes Booth. Let's just take a glance at the last 45 years. Lee Harvey Oswald. That's the John F. Kennedy assassination. Sirhan Sirhan. That's the Robert Kennedy assassination. James Earl Ray. That's the Martin Luther King assassination. They decided not to trouble our pretty little heads about who killed Malcolm X. Lieutenant William Calley. That's the My Lai massacre, one of 1,000 U.S. massacres of unarmed Vietnamese civilians, but the only one given any publicity. Tough luck, Lieutenant. Specialist Charles Grainer and his sexy illicit bedmate Lindy England. Sexual hanky-panky always helps secure a conviction. Chuck and Lindy got the slammer for single-handedly, or is that double-handedly? Anyway, they're responsible for the 10,000 documented cases of torture, including sexual humiliation at Abu Ghraib. Speaking of ladies' underpants, by the sheerest coincidence, these 10,000 instances resemble remarkably the 5,000 documented cases of torture at Guantanamo. Maybe that's what happened to Britney's underwear. And Paris Hilton's and Sharon Stone's, too. The ladies donated them to Chuck and Lindy to aid the interrogation of devout Muslim male prisoners. Sorry, detainees. Anyway, technically, Chuck and Lindy were not lone gunmen. Three or four other enlisted hillbillies from Hallelujah Hollow, Tennessee, also got the slammer for Abu Ghraib. The important point is that our beloved W had nothing to do with it. Condoleezza, Dick, Donald, and the inimitable Nancy Pelosi had nothing to do with it. God, if a half dozen army enlisted men can do that much damage, imagine what a couple of drunken corporals could do. Watch for them this winter when the U.S. accidentally nukes Tehran. Look, I know this game of mine could go on forever. Like the Exxon Valdez. Who's responsible for this hemisphere's worst oil spill? Not Exxon management, which refused to install $10 million of safety equipment that was required by law and by contract with the Alaskans? No, it was the alcoholic captain. So what if he was on schedule, asleep at the time of the smash-up, and another officer was in control of the ship? If control is the right word for a single-hulled oil tanker in treacherous waters and lacking millions of dollars worth of required safety equipment... But I'm in danger of becoming a bore and a conspiracy theorist. Let's cut to the chase, Manhattan Bank. Some other atrocities are perpetrated, not by lone gunmen, but by nobody. Just a tragic accident. Like the nuclear explosion at Three Mile Island, Pennsylvania, that didn't happen only through the grace of God. Like the unfortunate accidental explosion at Dow Chemical's plant in Bhopal, India. Like Chernobyl. Okay, that one I can't blame on the Republican Party. I think. And like our subject for today, Israel's 1967 attack on a non-combatant U.S. naval vessel, sometimes called a ship, in international waters. An hour and a half long attack, by air and by sea, with machine gun bullets, rockets, napalm bombs, and torpedoes. An attack that almost reached its goal of sinking the ship and killing every sailor on board. You've heard of the Maine, the Maddox, the Pueblo, the Mayaguez, the Exxon Valdez. Can you name this ship? Most people can't. Chances are, if Cuba conducted the same attack, we could, and we'd be watching the hit movie Day of Infamy, Part 2. I have a lapel pin bearing the initials WWSD. That stands for What Would Shakespeare Do? At this point, he'd give the audience a little comic relief. He'd bring in a drunken gravedigger or a couple of soldiers telling every dirty joke possible in Elizabethan England. Here's Roy Zimmerman's group in 1995, The Four Men.
We used to take a non-violent stance in Nehru jackets and bell-bottom pants. We even used to sing, "Give Peace a Chance." God, we must have been joking. We used to slander the words of our press and praise whatever the Tao Te Ching says. We used to want to sing like Joan Baez. Jesus, what were we smoking?
Now when someone says,
"Hell no, we won't go,"
what they mean is to Berkeley.
Peace is out, love is out. No one wants to hear about peace and love anymore. Now we're fighting in a war against homelessness, a war against drugs,
'cause it's in to be
in, to be
in, to be
in a war.
We used to traipse around in tie-dye tights, dropping daisies in enemy sights. Now we're fighting for property rights. Must have come to our senses.
We used to say all we needed was
love,
olive branches and sign of the dove. Now we're looking for something above 90K plus expenses.
Now when someone says,
"What the world needs now,"
it's a private police force.
Peace is out, love is out. No one wants to hear about peace and love anymore. Now we're fighting in a war against joblessness, a war against crime,
'cause it's in to be
in, to be
in, to be
in a war. A rat's ass about peace and love anymore. Now we're fighting
in a war against violence,
a war against poverty,
a war against ignorance,
a war against obesity,
a war against censorship,
a war against cavities.
'Cause it's in to be
Men from 1995, the Clinton years. Boy, those were the good old days, eh? Gasoline was a dollar a gallon. The economy was booming. Your dot-com stock was worth a fortune. Of course, Clinton did bring us NAFTA, which simultaneously threw people out of work in three different countries, all the way from Prudhoe Bay to the Yucatan Peninsula, and GATT. And he destroyed the welfare safety net, and turned the Democratic Party into the world's third greatest money laundering scheme, behind only the Pentagon and Enron. And what did the Republicans impeach him for? Wearing a suit with a cheap Chinese-made zipper that kept sliding down at inopportune moments. I think Janet Jackson had one, too. Did we impeach her?
My name is Phillips. It's not my real name. My real name is Zipper. When I got into this business, I had to change it. I couldn't see in one of those trade magazines, you know, Zipper opens in Chicago.
Okay, enough comic relief already. Hey, what could I have been thinking talking about the lone gunman, the lonely, misfit oddball who single-handedly pulls off some implausible crime? How could I forget the lone gunman du jour, Dr. Bruce Ivins, who single-handedly made a bunch of advanced weapons-grade anthrax and mailed it to all sorts of people, causing some deaths, like Lee Harvey Oswald and indeed James Earl Ray? Ivins had the decency to die before he could be brought to a trial, at which the government's case would be cross-examined. But we did hear a lot about what a misfit he was. Like, he drove 100 miles to the campus of Princeton University to mail the anthrax from a mailbox there because the mailbox was 100 yards from the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority house. And he had a lifelong fetish with Kappa Kappa Gamma girls for some reason. It's a lovely story that the press all reported, weakened only by the fact that there is no Kappa Kappa Gamma house at Princeton University. But what the heck? Anyway, Ivins is dead. Lee Harvey Oswald is dead. James Earl Ray is dead. That should dispel all doubts. Case closed. Let's wrap it up. But let us return to the Eastern Mediterranean and to our doomed Navy ship, the name of which, incidentally, is the USS Liberty. What a great headline. Israel destroys Liberty, replies Gaza. So what else is new? The Liberty was a spy ship doing electronic surveillance for the National Security Agency, possibly keeping an ear on Israel, probably trying to ascertain if the Soviet Air Force was assisting Egypt. It arrived 13 miles off the coast of Egypt, near the Gaza Strip, on the morning of June 8, 1967, and was attacked in the early afternoon. It was flying a new and large American flag and had its name and registration number painted in very large letters on its hull. It was armed only with 4 50-caliber machine guns. The first Israeli fighter plane on its first run at the ship destroyed all 4 guns. Here's what we'll do. We've covered the historical background and foreground. Now we'll read about the details of the attack from a fine article by Jeffrey St. Clair from his book, The Politics of Anti-Semitism, reprinted in Counterpunch in 2007. Condensed for radio by yours truly. Next week we'll read St. Clair's excellent discussion of the U.S. government and Pentagon cover-up, then his explanation of why the attack and why the cover-up. Here are the details of the attack, according to St. Clair. The Israeli military spotted the Liberty very soon after it arrived on June 8 and sent out reconnaissance planes to identify the ship. These planes made 8 trips over a period of 3 hours. The Liberty was flying a large U.S. flag and was easily recognizable as an American vessel. A few hours later, a group of Israeli Mirage 3 fighters approached the Liberty. They opened fire on the defenseless ship with rockets and machine guns. A few minutes later, a second wave of planes arrived, French-built Mystère jets, which pelted the ship not only with gunfire, but also with napalm bomblets, coating the deck with flaming jelly. By now, the Liberty was on fire, and dozens of sailors were wounded and killed, including several of the ship's top officers. The Liberty's radio team tried to issue a distress call, but discovered the frequencies had been jammed by the Israeli planes. Finally, an open channel was found, and the Liberty got out a message to the USS America, the Sixth Fleet's large aircraft carrier, that it was under attack. 2 F-4s left the carrier to come to Liberty's aid. Apparently, the jets were armed only with nuclear weapons. When word reached the Pentagon, Defense Secretary Robert McNamara became irate and ordered the jets to return. And the attack on the Liberty continued. After the Israeli fighter jets had fired all their rockets, three fast Israeli attack boats approached the Liberty. They launched two torpedoes at the crippled ship. One tore a 40-foot-wide hole in the hull, flooding the lower compartments and killing more than a dozen American sailors. The Liberty listed in the choppy seas, its deck aflame. Crew members dropped life rafts into the water and prepared to scuttle the ship. However, this soon proved impossible, as the Israeli attack boats strafed the rafts with machine gun fire. Nobody was going to get out alive that way. After more than 2 hours of unremitting assault, the Israelis finally halted their attack. Finally, 16 hours after the attack, two U.S. destroyers reached the Liberty. By that time, 34 U.S. sailors were dead and 174 injured, many seriously. A naval intelligence officer ordered the men not to talk to the press. The next morning, Israel launched a surprise invasion of Syria, violating the new ceasefire agreement. Here, Israel seized control of the Golan Heights. Within 3 weeks, the Navy put out a 700-page report exonerating the Israelis, claiming the attack had been accidental. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara suggested the whole affair should be forgotten. "These errors do occur," McNamara concluded. An officer of the Liberty, James Ennis, Jr., wrote an important book on the affair, published 1980 and revised and republished in 2007. Its title is Assault on the Liberty. Citing a large amount of solid evidence, the book argues that the Israeli attack was deliberate and that the U.S. government went to extraordinary lengths to disguise the truth. It's a story of Israeli aggression, Pentagon incompetence, official lies, and a cover-up that persists to this day. End of St. Clair's text. Does this remind anyone of September 11, 2001? And that about wraps up this edition of New World Notes, and thank you for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. This program is available by podcast or free download. Go to wwuh.org, find the description of this program, and there you'll find a very handy link that will take you to that service. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the presenter, the station management staff, or the licensee, or even, in this case, Leo the janitor, and their expression is protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Your comments and suggestions are most welcome. Send an email to kdowst, that's K-D-O-W-S-T, at hotmail.com. Until next time, here's wishing you a good week. Illegitimae non carborundum. Try to speak the truth and keep the faith.